Open Floor is brought to you by FanDuel, the leader in one-week fantasy sports with more winners and more payouts than any other site. Enter promo code OPENFLOOR at FanDuel.com to play a risk-free tournament for up to $10. We're also sponsored by the SeatGeek app, the easiest way to find a great deal, pay for your ticket, and get to your seat. Download the SeatGeek app and enter our code OPENFLOOR for $20 off your first purchase.
Did Michael Jordan push off?
Yeah, but I don't, you know, that happens about every play there is. You know, that's one that always everyone talks about. You know, I said, Michael's strong, but, you know, he's not that strong. So it was a combination. He caught Brian's momentum going one way, and he still had to make the shot, and he did.
Well, Jeff, I mean, Tom Chambers is going to be immortalized by the Sega Genesis game and his dunk in that game. He's got this dunk. It's a special dunk that only he can do, where he can double pump jam from beyond the three-point line.
Well, we saw a lot of reverse dunks and dunks over people. I don't ever remember him jumping from that far out, though.
Welcome back. SI.com NBA Podcast Episode 6. That's right. We're 6 episodes in now, and we're still going strong. Here at the SI.com podcast studio here in New York City, got a great podcast for you today. A great podcast. Baxter Holmes, the ESPN writer, covers the Lakers out in Los Angeles. He'll join the show, try to make some sense out of the strange dynamic that exists between Byron Scott, the coach, and D'Angelo Russell, the point guard out there. So we'll talk to Baxter later on the podcast. And Jeff Hornacek, the Phoenix Suns head coach, ex-Utah Jazz player, ex-Suns player. We'll talk to Jeff about a number of things later on as well. But before we get to the guest, the big story of last week was the Rockets' decision to fire Kevin McHale. And I'll admit, I was a little bit surprised by that decision because as bad as this team had played early on, and they had been porous defensively under McHale, they were still the Western Conference finalist last season. They still had a large part of the same core. Yeah, they brought in a new player in Ty Lawson who's had his troubles early on. They are still figuring out how to play without Josh Smith at the power forward spot. But I thought, given the fact that just a year ago they gave Kevin McHale a new contract and the success they had last year, that they would keep McHale for one more year. But it has become pretty clear now at this point that the front office believed that McHale, you know, saying he lost the locker room is strong, but it's kind of close to that, and that this defense under McHale wasn't going to get a lot better. And that's the big thing here. Defensively is where this team kind of made its bones last year. They weren't a great defensive team, a historic defensive team, but they were a lot better than what they were a year before, and that began with James Harden, who I thought took major strides on the defensive end of the floor. They've regressed, and they've regressed considerably since last season. So Daryl Morey, the GM there, clearly he felt that McHale was not going to be able to turn this thing around. They hired J.B. Bickerstaff, an assistant coach there already, a defensive mind, someone that's been entrusted with defense with that group, and they're hoping that Bickerstaff can be the one to turn this around. And look, it is not too late for the Rockets to turn this thing around. They still have more than enough talent to get back into the top 3, 4, 5 seeds in the Western Conference, but it's going to have to start on the defensive end of the floor. They've got to do better than the 100-plus points per night that they're giving up. They were giving up 100-plus points a night under McHale, even in games that they won. They were winning games by giving up 100-plus points per night. So that's priority number one for J.B. Bickerstaff. You've got to figure out Ty Lawson, who hasn't fit in all that well with this team early on. You've got to figure out the four spot. But I don't think it's panic time quite yet in Houston. I think the Rockets can still turn this thing around and be the contender we thought they'd be coming into the season. Looking forward a little bit, Houston's a very appealing job. You've got Harden. You've got Dwight Howard. You've got a really creative general manager in Daryl Morey, who has been unafraid in recent years to go big game hunting, to take chances, and to bring in the type of superstar talent you need to win a championship. Now, who would be an option out there for him? When the firing happened, the first name that jumped to my mind was Tom Thibodeau. Thibodeau's a free agent. He's going to want to get back into coaching sooner rather than later. They're familiar with him, with Houston, because he was an assistant for Jeff Van Gundy for many years. He's a defensive mind. Now, they'll have to get over the idea that they're going to be this up-tempo team under Tom Thibodeau, but he will get them playing a very high-level brand of defense. And if you're looking at the available coaches out there, and there are some good ones, Scott Brooks is going to be out there. Certainly Thibodeau, top of the list. Jeff Van Gundy might decide he wants to get back into coaching, among others. But Tibbs, the way he teaches defense, and he was in the Rockets camp during training camp. He was doing his rounds, visiting camps. I saw him talking to McHale. I saw him talking to the front office execs. It was just cordial, just casual. But if you're going to really try to change the defensive culture, bringing in a coach like a Tom Thibodeau, I think, is a great idea for this team. His offenses, they won't be this run-and-gun, up-tempo type of system, but defensively, you'll get a lot better. And you'll see James Harden, much like Derrick Rose did when he was healthy, I think play extremely well under Tom Thibodeau. All right, quick break. When we come back, Jeff Hornacek, Phoenix Suns head coach, he's going to join the podcast. Stay tuned for that. Just as radio broadcasts and cable TV networks revolutionized the sports fan experience, fantasy sports has done it again. Now with Daily Fantasy, it can finally pay to be a fan. This fall on FanDuel.com, you can play fantasy basketball, football, and hockey. If you ever wanted to try Daily Fantasy but haven't ever given it a shot, use my code OPENFLOOR on FanDuel.com for a risk-free tournament entry of up to $10. Here's what it's all about. FanDuel is a daily sports fantasy competition where you can win cash and there is no waiting for payment. Winners get paid the same night of their victory. There's no long drafts, and you can pick your team in minutes with the salary cap format. There are thousands of open leagues every day of the 15-16 NBA season. There's no season-long commitment, and league entries start at just $1. Over 2 million players have won money playing fantasy sports on FanDuel. Now it's your turn. Go to FanDuel.com and click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner. Use the code OPENFLOOR and sign up now. Here's a great new offer for my listeners. If you enter a league and you don't win, FanDuel will refund your money. That's any contest you want, up to 10 bucks. You can sign up on FanDuel.com using my code OPENFLOOR, then make a deposit and choose your league. If you don't win, you'll get that money right back in your FanDuel account. FanDuel.com, where every day is a new season. That's FanDuel.com. Try it out today. Welcome back, SI.com podcast. Chris Mannix, senior writer, Sports Illustrated, SI.com here. Baxter Holmes, the ESPN writer, covers the Lakers. He'll join us later on the podcast. But first, let's bring in Jeff Hornacek, former Phoenix Suns guard, former Utah Jazz guard, former 76ers guard for a cup of coffee, now the head coach of the Phoenix Suns, and Jeff joins us here on the podcast. Jeff, best shooter you've ever seen?
Best shooter I've ever seen. I still always go with Larry Bird.
Really? Nobody, Reggie Miller, Ray Allen, Steph Curry, still Bird?
Yeah, well, you know what? I'd say Reggie and Ray are right there at the top. And now I'm watching Curry night in and night out. I don't know. He might be there now. He's phenomenal.
Is there a special category for Steph Curry, like best on ball shot maker? I don't know. However you describe it. Is there like a special category for a guy like him?
Yeah. Best, well, he's obviously the best video game shooter there is too. I don't even think, real life, he shoots better than a lot of video game shoots. So I think just the way he plays, the unselfishness, and when he needs to make a shot, he makes it all the time.
When you were playing at Iowa State, when you finished, did you think you were going to be an NBA player?
Well, you know, senior year, Johnny Orr was telling me teams were calling and asking for tape. So I thought I might get drafted back then. There were seven rounds. So I thought maybe I could get drafted, but I did pretty well in the Chicago pre-draft camp, and then Phoenix had talked to me there. So they said we had 3 second-round picks, and if I'm still around, they were going to pick me with one of them. So at that point, that's where I knew I'd get drafted, but I still didn't count on making it in the NBA. You know, it's very difficult, especially second-rounders, to make it. So, you know, I was pretty excited when John McCloud came to me and said, well, you made it. So, yeah, it was a little bit of a surprise.
Should the NBA go back to 7 rounds of the draft?
No, you know, I think it's good the way it is. That way, you know, some of those lower round picks have an opportunity to pick and choose where they want to go try out. You know, if you're a seventh round pick and, you know, the Golden State Warriors pick you, they don't have any spots on their team. So, you know, you're there through training camp, you're there, then you're going to get cut. So I kind of like it this way. It gives guys that, you know, might have a chance on certain teams to have a choice where they want to try out.
If you didn't get drafted, what would you have done?
Well, I had two jobs lined up at Big 8 firms prior to the draft. I was an accounting major. You know, I might have tried playing overseas, but at that point, they were really back then, I think the only guys that were playing in Europe were the big guys. You know, they had enough guards over there. So I'd probably be working at some accounting firm right now. I don't know.
So you'd be an accountant. Jeff Hornacek, CPA.
Probably, if I'd have been able to pass a test.
Do you think you would have?
It would have been tough. You know, I heard nightmares about that test, but obviously when you're accounting major in college, it was tough to do all of the work that it takes to do that. So I would have had to do a lot of studying.
Is it wrong that I can almost picture you as an accountant, Jeff?
Is it wrong? You know, it was one of those things when I was going through high school, we had a career day and you had to go to three different, spots to get the lecture. And I went to, I forget what the two other ones were, but, a friend of mine's father was an accountant. So I said, okay, I'll go to that one. And I was good at math all the time. So, that kind of just how it fed into doing that.
You played with Tom Chambers earlier in your career. How good a dunker was Tom Chambers?
Tom was pretty good. He always amazed me because he was a guy who played in low tops, did not tape, and he was a guy that consistent every night. He would drive from the three-point line and take one or two dribbles and then dunk over somebody. And never sprained his ankle. So he was a big part of, you know, the success we had when we were in Phoenix because of his probably that stretch four. You know, he could shoot the three. Again, we didn't shoot that many of them back then, but he was an outside threat. And then if they came up on him, he just drove and jumped over the top of people. And obviously everybody knows the Mark Jackson one that you see all the time on the highlights. But he had several other ones besides that.
Well, Jeff, I mean, Tom Chambers is going to be immortalized by the Sega Genesis game and his dunk in that game. Have you ever played in that particular game?
I have not played any of those.
He's got this dunk. It's a special dunk that only he can do, where he can double pump jam from beyond the 3-point line.
Well, we saw a lot of reverse dunks and dunks over people. I don't ever remember him jumping from that far out, though.
Do you ever look back at some of the things players did back in the day, like wearing low tops, like not taping, and think about how different it was back then?
Well, you know, crazy dunking guys. I mean, I played with Larry Nance. I threw a ball when I was a rookie. I thought it was in about the 12th row on a lob, and I swear he caught that thing at almost the top of the backboard and dunked it. you know, you had Dominic Wilkins with all the dunks he would do, and obviously Michael, you know, and some of the phenomenal reverse dunks and dunks over the top of people. But I think the biggest thing that the old guys always talk about, how you have to take that 6 a.m. flight the next morning, 6 a.m. bus to get to the first flight out, and you had to go play that night. You know, there was no commercial or charter flights. So flying commercial and then having to still play was pretty tough.
Your worst travel experience in your playing days?
Oh, I don't know. I can't remember any too bad of travel experiences. We missed one flight back in the day because one of my teammates forgot. Back then, we had to carry our own uniform. Then we got back to the airport. We ran back to the house, grabbed the uniform, ran to the airport, and they had just pulled the jetway back from the plane, and they wouldn't let us on. So we actually had to, you know, sit around the airport, catch a later flight, and go right to the game in Sacramento, and basically went from the airport right to the game.
Wow. Who was the worst traveler you ever played with?
Well, played with Mike McGee. He did not like to fly. And, you know, the ruthless players that, you know, teammates that you have, he would hold on to the armchairs, and anytime the play would start shaking, you know, he got pretty scared, and guys would be, "Hey, Mike, we're going down. And they were like, "Not too kind," but he didn't like to fly. And then, 2 years ago, we had Shavlik Randolph, who didn't like to fly. So, it made for some interesting times.
The first time you were traded, Jeff, did it hurt?
Oh yeah. You know, I was here in Phoenix. We had been here for 6 years. We, you know, kind of went through the big drug scandal thing that happened here. Everybody on the team was new except for me. We went from 28 wins to 55 wins, you know, 3-4 years in a row. And, you know, maybe it was being naive. You know, I thought I was going to be a Phoenix Sun my whole career. And then I got a call from, you know, a friend of ours in Chicago and asked us if we were okay. And we're like, "Yeah, why? What's going on?" "Oh, you haven't heard." And we said, "No, what?" He said, "You've been traded to Philadelphia for, you know, in the Barkley deal." So, you know, that was tough because we felt such a big part of the Phoenix community and being part of the turnaround. And but, you know, I understood basketball-wise why they did it. You know, you're getting an all-star, Hall of Fame guy in Charles Barkley, so I knew it would help him.
You eventually wind up in Utah, and I think a lot of people that follow your career almost know you more for being Jeff Hornacek, the Utah Jazz player, than the Jeff Hornacek, the Suns player. I mean, what was it about your time in Utah that was most memorable to you?
Well, I think it was, you know, playing in the finals two times against Jordan and in those Bulls teams. I think if you look back at all the television ratings, I think our finals against the Bulls, and maybe it was 97, was the highest rated ever. Had some share like 22 point something. And then I think the Phoenix one against the Bulls was second, and then our other finals was third. So, you know, a lot of people had watched those series, and they were some great series, so that's probably why.
Did Michael Jordan push off?
Yeah, but I don't, you know, that happens about every play there is. You know, that's the one that always everyone talks about. But, you know, I said, "Michael's strong, but, you know, he's not that strong." So it was a combination. He caught Brian's momentum going one way, and he still had to make the shot, and he did.
Your favorite memory of playing for Jerry Sloan?
Favorite memory of Jerry Sloan. You know, Jerry was so great to play for because he was intense. You know, he demanded a lot out of you. But then after the game, you know, if you wanted to go have a beer, you know, he'd have a beer with you. So, you know, the game kind of ended, it was over, and you moved on to the next one. And, I think just his intensity of having the guys play as a team, you know, emphasizing moving the ball, the tough-nosed defense, you know, that's the way he played as a player, that's the way he coached, and you know, it was always fun to play for him.
What I loved about Jerry, Jeff, was he always ate dinner in the media room. Him, Phil Johnson, they go down there. Only coach I've ever seen that sat in the media room before games and ate dinner.
Well, you know, he didn't have to worry about a lot. He had John Stockton and Karl Malone. You know? he could enjoy his dinner.
Your most memorable interaction between Sloan and Greg Ostertag?
Well, I don't know. You know, Greg was... John, Carl, and I were all different. We were kind of business-like. You know, there wasn't a lot of rah-rah, jumping around. You know, we did our jobs. You know, that's what we were supposed to do. And Greg was the one that was waving to the crowds and getting the crowd to stand up. And, you know, Jerry, you know, he didn't really like that. And we were always saying, "Oh, let him do it. You know, if he gets his 16 or 17 rebounds, we don't care what he does." So, you know, Jerry was that serious guy that on the court, "Hey, play basketball. You don't need to be focusing in the stands, focus between those baselines and sidelines." And, you know, so he got on Greg a few times for that.
You retired from the game in 2000, didn't really get back into it until around 2007. What'd you do with yourself all those years?
Well, watching the kids grow up. You know, that's kind of why I retired. You know, I figured I played 14 years. My wife had to watch the kids for all those years, and I missed a lot of stuff that they were involved in. And I said, you know what? I was playing to win a championship. And I felt at that point, John and Carl and I, we were all, you know, 37, 38, 39 years old, that we could still be good and get in the playoffs and win a round or two, but we weren't going to win a championship. And so I felt it was a good time to retire and spend time with the family. So, you know, that's what I did.
When you first retired, did you get any calls in that first year to come back?
Well, you know, my brother-in-law is Aaron Nelson, the trainer for the Suns. That's my wife's brother.
Yep.
And I can remember a lot of times that first year, he would call after one of the Suns games, and he goes, "I have Jason Kidd here." And I said, "All right." And they go, "Jason," we get on the phone, he goes, "Hey, just come play for us. Just come play for us. I'll get you 10, 12 shots a game. You won't have to do anything. Just run down the court. I'll find you and just shoot it." And so that was kind of a funny running thing that he probably called, I don't know, 5-6 times that year to see if I would come out of retirement and play. But I felt at that point that, you know, if anything, I probably would have came back to the Jazz if they would have called and had an injury late in the season. But, you know, as it was fine not playing.
So you weren't tempted by those Jason Kidd phone calls?
Well, it was tempting. You know, Jason is such a great player, just like John Stockton. He's going to get you the ball, and you run up and down the court and just fire away. But, you know, again, why I quit was to be around the family.
What brought you back in 2007 when you were, I think, a special assistant, you know, kind of easing your way back into it? What was it that got you back into the game?
Well, the first thing was the Jazz had called, and Andre Kirilenko was having some problems, you know, with his confidence and his shooting. And they said, "Hey, you know, would you come and work with Andre a little bit?" It was right before the playoffs. And so I said, "Sure." So, you know, I went back there and worked with Andre for, you know, 2-3 days before the playoffs. And that's when he hit a big three-pointer against the Rockets to help them win that series. And then the next year, I said, "Hey, will you do it a little more consistently? And so I said, "Well, you know, I don't want to travel. I don't want to be away from the family, but I could do like a day. I come in the morning." So what I did was I flew out in the morning from Phoenix. I lived here in Phoenix, and worked with Andre before practice, after practice. I would stay overnight and then do before practice, after practice, and I would fly back to Phoenix in time for my kids' games. So I was able to schedule when I could do that. And, you know, that was fun to get back involved in the game, yet still not miss anything to my kids. And then as the years went on, you know, there's Cal Korver, Wes Matthews that, you know, did a few things with. And then it got to the point where I was staying two nights in 3 days because some of the other guys wanted to do some stuff. And then when Jerry and Phil decided to, you know, step away, they asked me, "Hey, you know the plays, you know the players. Will you finish the season out and go full time?" And that was tough because I didn't want to. At that point, my daughter was a junior in high school, and I could finish the year out. But then when it came to the next year, and she was a senior in high school, and she was our youngest, it was a big, you know, thought: should I do this or not? And I thought if I wanted to get back into it full time, that I probably should do it. So. You know, my wife and I talked about it and said, "Yeah, let's do it."
Did you like coaching when you got into it? Was it something that, you know, once you started doing, you kind of got the bug?
Well, I probably always felt like I would go into coaching. You know, my dad was a coach, so I've always kind of been around it. The way I played, I felt, you know, I was the most athletic guy in the world, but I felt I knew the game pretty well, and that's how I survived for 14 years. So, you know, I always thought maybe I would coach, but I really thought it probably would be on the college level because I felt I would have enough knowledge to help some of these kids make it to the pros. But nowadays, the game is almost like a college game. These kids are coming out at 18, 19 years old, and you have to train them, and you have to show them the little things, and it's not all about X's and O's when you're a pro coach. You gotta, you know, try to get them developed.
You think you could handle coaching today's college game? I mean, it's so different. I mean, in so many ways with recruiting and one and dones. How would you have handled being a college coach today?
Well, you know, I had talked about this when Isaiah Thomas. I knew Isaiah a little bit, and he played at my dad's high school, and I had called him once and asked him about it when he was coaching at Florida International, whatever it was. And he said, the advantage we have as ex-NBA guys who were pretty successful is that most of these kids want to play in the NBA. And they see that you did it, and, you know, through hard work and how you got there. And he goes, recruiting is easier because of that. So in a way, I said, oh, you know, it's possible. It won't be as bad. But, you know, one and done probably make it a little difficult, but it's something you would just adjust to.
Who would you say your coaching influences have been?
Well, probably every single coach I've had, from my dad to Johnny Orr at college, to obviously Cotton Fitzsimmons, John McLeod, and Jerry Sloan. You know, all those guys, I try to take different things from when I'm coaching. You know, the Cotton, the very positive, trying to be positive with the guys. Sometimes I find myself a little more like Jerry, getting on guys and trying to push them to another level. And Johnny Orr, just, hey, have fun with the game. You know, just enjoy it. So, you know, I think everybody is formed by their previous coaches.
Your first days as a head coach, nervous?
I don't think nervous. I think, you know, there's a real realization that that's a lot of stuff. It comes at you quickly, especially that first year. You know, when you're a player, you get your scouting report, you watch a little tape, you go home after shoot around, you get to rest all afternoon, and the game ends, you go home, you know, you could kind of chill out. As a coach, you're watching, there's always more tape to watch. So my wife says she sees me less now as a head coach living in the same city as when I was an assistant living, you know, going back and forth to Utah and doing that. So it's a big job. It takes a lot of hours, and you know, that's the surprise of it.
Would Jeff Hornacek, the player, be comfortable playing for Jeff Hornacek, the coach?
Yeah, I would think so. You know, but then again, I always felt as a player, I could play for any coach. I could play for Johnny Orr, Cotton Fitzsimmons, to Bobby Knight and Jerry Sloan. I think that's probably just the way I was raised, is in a basketball family with my dad being a coach, and, you know, you did what the coach asked, and, yeah, that would be easy.
I'll get you out of here with this, Jeff. You guys, this year, having gone through changes at the middle of last year in the offseason, playing some real defense with this group this year, are you happy with what you've seen so far? What do you hope to see in the coming months?
Yeah, obviously when we added Tyson Chandler, we felt that we can improve defensively. And not only from his influence, but our other guys. Eric Bledsoe's very good on-ball defender. He's got great instincts. He's strong. You know, P.J. Tucker's a defensive player. You know, we knew we might step back a little bit in the offensive side of it. But, you know, ultimately, the shots aren't going down, and you're playing good defense, you can still win some games and squeak some out. So, you know, our biggest thing in the past has been a lot of young guys who, you know, positioning and feel for the game maybe wasn't quite to where we wanted it. We have more veteran players now who have a better understanding of the game. And, you know, the biggest thing for us is, are you helping your teammate defensively? You know, if you're just worried about your own man, it's not going to be good. And so far this year, we have a little grading system that we keep track of things. And, you know, those are big points of emphasis for us. Are we in the proper help position? Are we closing out hard to shooters? And we're tracking that stuff and just trying to improve on it.
Well, Jeff, I really appreciate the time here. And do me a favor. If you get a chance at home, Google Tom Chambers Sega. And tell me later if he can do that, if he is able to do that dunk in real life.
All right, I will.
Thanks, Jeff.
All right, Chris, thanks.
Take care. All right, we'll take one more quick break. When we come back, Baxter Holmes, ESPN writer, covers the Lakers out in Los Angeles. He'll join us next. Stay tuned for that. It's Thanksgiving week, and it's important that you know how much we appreciate you, the listeners. Time is the most valuable gift you can give us, and we work very hard to make sure we are paying back your investment. We welcome your feedback, questions, and comments. Just get in touch with me on Twitter, @ChrisManixSI, or tweet my producer, Alan Kim, @AlanXKim. Thanks again. We really do appreciate you. We also want to thank SeatGeek, presenting sponsor of this show and the entire SI network. There may not be any pro basketball games on Thanksgiving, But for every other day of the NBA season, SeatGeek has you covered. Their app is the fastest, easiest way to find great deals on tickets. Now, when you use my code OPENFLOOR in the SeatGeek app, you get a check back for $20. Here's how it works. You download the SeatGeek app on your iPhone or Android. It's free and takes less than a minute to download. Then you search for your event, find the deal you want, enter our code OPENFLOOR, and when you complete your purchase, they'll send a $20 check to your house. It's that easy. SeatGeek pulls in ticket options from hundreds of online sellers and shows you the best deals automatically. They also have this cool feature called Deal Score. It ranks every ticket on the market with a value score and plots the best deals on a color-coded map of the venue. Finally, SeatGeek's mobile app makes the ticket buying process seamless, easy, and safe. You can store your credit card, and once you find a ticket you want to buy, you can make the purchase with two quick taps of your phone. So, to redeem your promo code and get your $20 check, download the free SeatGeek app today, enter promo code OPENFLOOR in the app. SeatGeek will then send you $20 once you've made your first SeatGeek purchase. If you want to see the NBA, the NFL, or the best concerts, use the SeatGeek app and enter our code OPENFLOOR to save $20. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. Let's bring in Baxter Holmes, ESPN NBA writer, covers the league and lives in Los Angeles now, covering the Lakers. The thin-skinned Baxter Holmes, who quit on the city of Boston, unfortunately, and decided to move to LA. What's up, Baxter?
Oh man, I'm doing well, and I'm enjoying right now the cooler weather here. Although it's not going to be, you know, quite what the winters and fall are in the place I left, New England.
Anyone that leaves Boston, I just basically call them a quitter, because I moved to New York, but I still keep an apartment in the Boston area for all the Celtic stuff that I do. So I didn't technically quit on Boston. I just share it a little bit more now.
Well, you know, one day when I'm making that SI money, I can keep two apartments at once.
Yeah. I have a beanbag chair and a futon. That's what's in my apartment. Okay. let's be real with the listeners on what exactly my Boston apartment really looks like. All right. On a scale of 1 to 10, how much does Byron Scott dislike D'Angelo Russell?
Oh boy, you know what? If you're just looking at the minutes alone, and the situations in which Russell is playing, I gotta say it's probably somewhere. It's definitely above 5, and I'm just gonna ballpark it at 7. I'm not so sure it's so much that it's Russell specifically, so much as that he's a 19-year-old rookie. I think anybody in that position is just in a really tough spot. But you know, unfortunately for Russell, it's him. He's the one in that position. When we've seen, I think in 4 of their first 10 games, Russell hasn't played at all in the fourth quarter. And initially some of those games were kind of close a little bit. And so, you know, Byron's thinking was, well, it's kind of close. I'd rather have Lou Williams in there and his veteran experience to hopefully potentially get us a win. But then, you know, some of those games were blowouts, and his reasoning afterwards was, oh, the games were too far out of, you know, the score was too lopsided. There was no point in playing D'Angelo. And everybody just kind of cocked their head like, wait a minute, what's going on? So I don't quite have an understanding of what their plan is in terms of Russell. I mean, he hasn't looked great, but he also hasn't played a lot. So I'm not sure how to really judge who he is and what he's done. After 20, 25 games, I'll be really interested to see what his minutes have looked like, if he starts to give him a little bit more of a rope or not.
I'm kind of incredulous, Baxter, at what I've seen out there, because I do the draft over here at SI. I spent some time at Ohio State. I watched him play. He hasn't been a real point guard in a couple of years anyway. High school, he shared the responsibility. Last year at Ohio State, he took the role from Shannon Scott, but it was him and Shannon Scott that were splitting those duties as well. If they expected D'Angelo Russell to come in and be more effective than he is, I'm surprised, because everyone out there that I talked to knew they were kind of playing the long game with him, because they knew it was going to take him time to adjust that position. I'm just surprised that they're not accepting the fact that, yeah, he's probably going to commit 4 or 5 turnovers a game, but if you give him minutes, he'll eventually get better. He's just not getting the minutes I think a young player like him really needs to get better.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it's more puzzling to me that they're not giving him the minutes, considering that, you know, this is a rebuilding season. This is a season that's perfect for giving young players the kind of minutes they need to develop. And whether it's him, Julius Randle, even, you know, Clarkson, this is a perfect opportunity. They can't really say, oh, you know, we're focused on playing veterans because we want to make a postseason run, or, oh, you know, this or that. No, there's no excuse. There's absolutely no excuse for not playing these guys and allowing them to make mistakes and play through them. You know, you can go through past young point guards. A lot of them have had high turnover rates. You know, Russell Westbrook, even Steve Nash. Yeah. And that's just part of being a rookie point guard or young point guard. You make mistakes, you adjust to the pace of the game, particularly in the Western Conference. D'Angelo is going to go up against some of the, you know, best players in the NBA who happen to play his position. And they're going to tear him up on a night-to-night basis, but he's going to play through that. He's going to learn, get better. That's just part of it. I don't see the reasoning or the logic behind not playing a rookie point guard considering where the Lakers are at right now.
What's your personal evaluation of Russell? I know it's very early in the season, not even to the first third point of the season. But here in New York, like I see Kristaps Porzingis play, and I know Kristaps Porzingis is going to be a good player down the line because you can see early on that he has that, you know, quote, feel for the game that you see in some young players. Do you see signs of that feel from Russell, or are you just not sure yet?
There's been flashes, particularly during the preseason. You know, he looked pretty rough during the summer league. During the preseason, a couple of those games, all throughout, you know, there were flashes of his court vision that was just exceptional. His ability to find guys, you know, and fit the ball through a small window and lead them, you know, it gives you the sense that these are passes that only maybe a handful of guys in the NBA could make. This is what a lot of people talked about him, that he has that ability. I mean, you think back to some of his highlight reel passes when he was at Ohio State. But it seems like he's also playing with a kind of I'm trying to think of what the word is. I don't know, fear of just being yanked by Byron if he turns it over, you know. And we've seen Byron yank him after some of these turnovers. And so if there's a hesitation from D'Angelo to try to make some pass that, you know, is really a highlight pass that he can kind of make and maybe only a handful of guys can make, it's because of that short leash. But it's been hard to evaluate. Now, certainly we look at some of the other rookies. Look at Okafor, you look at Porzingis, you look at Towns, obviously. Moutier's had some nice games, even though he's turned the ball over quite a bit. And then you look at Russell, it's a completely different situation. I think his lack of production, his lack of minutes are even more glaring, considering how good a lot of the rookies look around him.
What do you think Byron Scott's mandate is this season? Because if it was just develop the young players, you figure he'd let Russell play through these mistakes. You know, a guy you mentioned, Russell Westbrook. God, people forget how bad Russell Westbrook and that Thunder team was in his first year out there. They were like 3-29 or something to start one of those seasons. They were awful, but he played through his mistakes. He got better. It's just hard for me from afar, Baxter, to really understand what Byron's mandate is with this team. Is it develop young guys? Is it to win at all costs? I mean, what do you see it as that being?
I think this season is devoted completely to being a shrine for Kobe Bryant. Where developing these players is, where does that rank? You know, I mean, it's top five, but I don't know exactly how closer it is to five than it is to one. You know, I think it seems like the first priority overall is to do whatever Kobe wants and what could be his final NBA season. After that, it seems like trying to be competitive somehow, even though that seems like an impossible task given the roster, given the conference they're in, just given the youth of so many of their players, development of some of their guys. That would, you know, I've talked to many people around the league who've said this needs to be their number one overall priority if the Lakers want to get back to contending status anytime soon. But it seems like that's pretty, you know, that's lower on the list. And it certainly feels that way when we're seeing in games, you know, if it's Russell not getting, you know, a lot of minutes, or if they're playing Brandon Bass a lot more over Randle, or what, if there just seems like there's kind of a really tight leash on some of these young players, when really it feels like this is the time when they should have the longest leash to just be out there for long stretches and anything like that. And in the end also, I mean, let's remember, it bodes well for the Lakers to lose this year. So by playing, because they could at the end of the year keep their top three protected pick that otherwise goes to Philly. So the Lakers to lose and to develop these young players in the process, that's a win-win. But there's times when it feels like they want to do the exact opposite for whatever reason.
Do you slap your head as a former Celtics beat writer when you see Brandon Bass playing minutes over Julius Randle?
It makes me wonder kind of what's going on. It's the same thing with seeing Lou Williams playing over D'Angelo Russell. There's basketball logic here, and by no means do I consider myself like, you know, I'm like always right or I'm 100% right. But there's certain things that feel like it's just common sense, and then there's certain things that happen during the course of some games here that completely run counter to that, and counter to what just some organizational type decisions would be in order to try to run a good franchise. And I get texts, it feels like on a nightly basis, from people around the league who are asking me, like, what's going on? Why are they doing this? Why are they doing that? And I don't really have any good answers. You know, I'm as perplexed most of the time as anyone. I'm watching it unfold right in front of me.
You know what's going to be a great bad game? December 5th in Philadelphia, Lakers at Sixers. Sixers with an opportunity, bear with me here, Sixers who probably at that point will have the opportunity to break the Nets' 0-18 record to start the season because, you know, they'll probably be in that mix. And the Lakers, who the Sixers have no incentive to beat, because if they beat them, the Lakers are a little bit worse. They get that lower pick. That's kind of one of those sneaky, must-see, awful games, Baxter.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny you mentioned that game, because I was talking to somebody a couple days ago, and then here's what I think is going to happen, and it happened last year as well. In both times when they match up this year, the Lakers and the 76ers, the Lakers will win that game, even though they absolutely should not. And at the end of the season, if they end up losing that pick, you know, it could come back to haunt them. Last year, they beat the 76ers in both those matchups, and they were what I deemed must-lose games for the Lakers, considering what the protection was on their pick. They ultimately ended up keeping it. I feel like this year, they'll beat the 76ers in both those games, and then the end of the year will come, they'll lose that pick, and they'll look back and say, oh, dang, we should have lost those games. So, you know, but, you know, if only we could have gone back and done it over again, even though, you know, they clearly knew going in what could be the case. So that's my prediction. I fully expect it to happen. And, yeah, that 76ers Lakers game, I mean, both of them this year, I mean, they're really going to, you know, James Naismith would roll over in his grave. They're going to be abominations.
People out there, Baxter, they think that there'll be this conspiracy to get the Lakers the number one overall pick or something. I was in the lottery room last year when everyone thought the Knicks would get the first overall pick. It'd be a way for them to rejuvenate a tentpole franchise. And I watched the Knicks representative put his head in his hands when they got number four overall. You know, those conspiracy theories don't carry a lot of water with me. Not when stuff like that happens last year.
Yeah, I was in the room with you, and I remember
that's the same
kind of sentiment. People were talking about either the Knicks are going to get the top overall pick or the Lakers are going to get the top overall pick, because, you know, it's good for business for the NBA for both those teams to do well, the marquee teams in its biggest markets. And that still remains true, but, you know, I don't really buy a lot of those conspiracy theories either. More to the point, I think it hurts the Lakers a little bit more, their perception a little bit more, to see Porzingis doing as well as he did. I mean, if we remember back a little bit when the Lakers were in New York and Byron Scott was talking about how the Lakers passed on Porzingis because they thought he was going to take a lot of time to develop, and then he openly admits, obviously, wrong about that. And then meanwhile, he's sitting there benching his team's number two overall pick while praising the guy that they could have taken. It's just, I mean, at times it's madness.
And that's the thing too. Byron has this rep, you know, for better or for worse, of being a good point guard developer. I mean, he didn't really develop Jason Kidd. He was already a star. But, you know, you get Kyrie Irving in Cleveland. You have Chris Paul in the fledgling stages of his career in New Orleans. I mean, maybe both those guys probably would have developed into stars anyway. But, you know, you're not seeing that same type of point guard guru that maybe some expected with Byron and D'Angelo early on.
Let's be honest here. Jason Kidd was what he was before he got to New Jersey.
Yes.
Chris Paul was always going to be Chris Paul. He is that good. And Kyrie Irving is that good. And I've had more people say this to me with anything, particularly when I've gotten a discussion about D'Angelo. They're saying the notion that Byron truly developed these guys is a misnomer. They were that good.
Yeah.
And they were always going to be that good. It didn't necessarily matter who the coach was. Yeah, I mean, if the coach was an absolute disaster. It could have maybe stunted their growth, but these guys were that talented that and that skilled that they were always going to be something. Byron, not to take too much away from, I think was just in the right place in the right time. But it, you know, D'Angelo is not these kind of guys. He's not so ready right out of the gate. He could develop into something special. I think a lot of our projection systems, I believe at a 5-30, project him as having potential, that kind of superstar potential. But I think the circumstances also have to be very much in his favor in terms of the environment that he's in, the coach that he has, the all of the things, the ingredients have to be there, I think, to help develop that within him. And if it doesn't, I think there's the potential, and that we also projected this, that he could be a bust. It's too early to say that. In my opinion, I want to see what he looks like at an actual floor time and growing and developing and playing through mistakes and whatnot. I'm just not sure if he's going to get that as it stands right now.
Fast forward for me, you know, a couple of months into the future. Let's say the rest of the month of November looks kind of like the way the first half or so of the month has looked like. Is this, is it survivable both for Kobe and Byron to have 4 to 5 more months that are by and large like the first one?
I don't know that much is going to change regardless. So, I mean, let's say that the status quo of right now continues. You know, Kobe's shooting percentage doesn't change much and he's missing more games to rest. Back-to-backs just don't happen anymore. Some of these long road trips, he's sitting out other games here and there. And he pretty much only plays in the reunion games or the farewell games that matter to him. So like Philly, Boston, stuff like that. And let's say that Lou Williams continues to get minutes over D'Angelo Russell and so on and so forth. And the Lakers continue to get blown out on a daily basis. Remember, they haven't even played Golden State yet. They haven't even played the Clippers yet, the Spurs, Oklahoma City. They haven't even played these title contenders. So let's say all of this keeps happening. I don't really think anything is going to change. The Lakers are going to continue to lose. They'll be that much closer to getting a potential, keeping their top pick. Yeah, there's going to be pressure perhaps on Byron. I mean, his seat definitely feels hotter than it did last year, but I don't see him. I don't see much changing in any kind of way. I mean, whether I just don't see anything changing.
What's the power structure in that organization going to look like a year from now? I mean, Jim Buss has said in the past, like, we're going to be back on track by X date, and they certainly don't look back on track. Jeannie, you know, there's been these threats maybe of her taking over for him. Are we going to see at some point in, say, the next 6 to 8 months, fundamental changes in the power structure within the Lakers?
No, I think the timeline for Jim Buss, so it's after next season, so after the 2015? So after the 2016-17 season, that's the supposed clock that has been set by him and established several times over by his sister Jeannie Buss, the Lakers president. I think at that point, that's when there's likely to be change. Before then, I'm less inclined to believe that change is certain. Now, if the situation, if this were another franchise facing the same kind of circumstances, like the same kind of record, the same kind of roster, so on and so forth, I think that would be a case. I think their coaching, you know, front office management, all that stuff, I could imagine very swift turnover. But the Lakers are different. There's just so many different dynamics at play. I mean, it's a family business. There's the stuff with Jeannie and Jim. There's the all the things with Kobe. You know, it's not even clear if he's going to retire at the end of this year, although it seems from the way he's playing and talking that this could be it.
You can't imagine Kobe coming back, though, can you? I mean, going through this again.
Yeah, I can't personally, but, you know, at the end of the year, if when he knows, obviously, all that TV money is coming in, and he knows that if he wants to play again, they're not going to say no to him.
Yeah.
There's always a possibility. There really is. And that's the kind of power that he wields over them.
The problem is, though, at least in my mind, like, they're not getting Kevin Durant. I mean, Kevin's not going there to – he's not going to leave a good Oklahoma City team or potentially a Washington team to go to a Laker team that's in the initial stages of a rebuild. And after Durant – I mean, people seem, you know, it's called a great, you know, class, but it's really not. I mean, Mike Conley's like the next big name out there. You got Al Horford in Atlanta. Those are two guys that play positions that the Lakers currently have occupied with their two, you know, young core players in Randall and Russell. So, I mean, you know, maybe they can make a trade. Maybe there's somebody out there that I'm not considering at the moment they could sign. But overall, I just don't see the Lakers getting another impact player next summer. I think it's the Roy Hibbert types or somebody they can, you know, pick off the scrap heap that's going to help them.
I agree completely with you, and you said it as well as it could be said about the free agent class. You know, they're so used to wanting to try to hit home runs. I think at this point they need to try for some singles and some doubles and build maybe a little bit slower than what they want. I've had a lot of people say to me, you know, the guy that they should really try to target is Russell Westbrook in 2 years. He's an LA guy. You can feel that his roots, that kind of thing. But in the same breath, a lot of them have said, you know, if your plan is really to try to get a guy in 2 years, and, you know, we don't know what's going to happen with Russell in 2 years. You know, what is his injury history going to look like by then? How will his body be holding up? What will the team be looking like then? Is Kevin on that team or is he not on that team? You know, so much could change in 2 years. So I think it's hard to really have a plan that far out when it comes to free agency. But I think, so this is, you know, I go back to this. I think for the Lakers, the best thing they can do right now to try to return to contending status is that you develop the guys that you have in-house. You develop D'Angelo Russell. You develop Julius Randle. You continue to develop Jordan Clarkson. You develop these guys and try to make the roster with them as attractive as it can be to then tell other players, look, you can be, we have some things, we have some stuff here, some nice stuff. You know, you can be an additional piece. You know, you live in LA, all of that. It might take longer than what the Lakers want, than what their fans are accustomed to, but bends the brakes. You know, you got to, if you want to get back to winning and get out of the cellar that they're in, I think you got to face reality.
All right, before I let you go, you've written more words on Rajon Rondo in the last few years than anybody out there. You know the guy, you've covered the guy extensively, both with the Globe and with ESPN. I was out there saying I don't think the Dallas thing was entirely his fault. I think Rick Carlisle had a lot to do with it. You know, Rondo is who he is, and he's not really accustomed to being having plays called all the time for him. But Carlisle, I think, could have handled that a little bit better as well. Now he's up in Sacramento. You know, this is kind of Rajon Rondo's last stand, and he's played pretty well recently. But what do you see for him down the line? I mean, how important is it for him to have not only a successful year on the floor, but be kind of, or change the perception of himself off it?
Yeah, it's kind of a renaissance a little bit for him in Sacramento right now. And to go back to the Dallas thing, I agree with you. I do not think it was entirely his fault. You know, Rick Carlisle has been known to be a pretty difficult guy for point guards to play for. We were talking earlier about point guards being on a short leash, and, you know, several of the point guards that have been under Rick have talked about that. Anyways, it was just a bad fit. There's no question about it. I think Rajon is very aware of his perception, particularly what the falling out in Dallas did to it, how important it is for him to repair his situation if he's going to continue to have an NBA career. If you remember back when he was with the Celtics, they were on a West Coast trip. He had his birthday, stayed in Los Angeles versus going up to Sacramento. And everyone was like, oh, what? You don't want to go with the team to Sacramento? You don't like Sacramento, whatever? Fast forward, and now he's playing there. It's kind of funny, you know, how everything comes back full circle. Now, I'm not sold on that he's completely back to his full self. He's putting up some pretty good numbers, but that situation also is weird. But everything that's going on in Sacramento, and I'm not sure what's going to play out the rest of the year. Who's going to be coaching and managing it? What players are going to come and go? But yeah, it's definitely been fun to see him kind of have some playoff Rondo type playoff games. And it's done a lot, I think, to help repair what obviously was a pretty awful situation in Dallas.
You know where I think he winds up? I think he winds up in Minnesota next year, because with Flip Saunders gone, I think the guy swinging the biggest stick with Glenn Taylor is Kevin Garnett. And we all know how much KG loves Rondo. Like, I could see that happening. Man.
You know what? That would be really fascinating. And now you have me thinking of, you know, him throwing alley-oop passes to Zach LaVine and Andrew Wiggins and feeding Karl Anthony Towns and whatnot. And then, of course, I'm assuming KG is going to be around. And you know, you have Rondo come in. And then I almost think that they're going to create, like, almost the environment that was like in Boston, where it's a very, you know, they're super cold towards the opponents. You know, just like everybody, us against them, just this villainous kind of attitude. That would be kind of fun to see, man. Actually, that would be awesome to see. I'm rooting for that to happen.
And you sign Kendrick Perkins, and then you've got almost the entire band back together. You're good.
Yeah, bring it. Yeah, Ray out. Get Ray back. Get Paul one more shot. I mean, you know, who knows what happens with Doc, you know, down there, if the Clippers thing doesn't fizzle out, maybe he can come there and they can make one more run. Why not? Just, you know, for old time's sake.
You know that Ray and Rondo aren't burying that hatchet. That hatchet is going to remain out for a long time.
Yeah, good point.
Well, Baxter, you do a terrific job over there at ESPN. Loved reading you at the Globe. Love reading you now. Thanks for taking some time to join the podcast, and we'll catch up with you soon.
My pleasure, man. Anytime.
Make sure to subscribe to the Open Floor Podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud. You can also find more great Sports Illustrated podcasts at si.com/podcast. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.